Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so dear Reverend Sir, this morning the stepwise process of attaining jhana through breath meditation was explained beautifully. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Sometimes it's nice to hear that you actually are getting the information across. That's nice. However, I was unable to catch up with your speed, and could you please repeat the process for us to note down? Okay. This will be useful, not only to participants, but our friends as well. Okay, but so the video recording will be available later on. Okay, so you can watch it later on. Yeah. Okay, so you're asking at what stage the nimitta appears? Well, roughly about stage 9 of the process. That's what I was saying. So that's easy enough. So roughly stage 9, when the breath calms down and you have all the bliss in the mind. Does nimitta precede silent present moment or follow it? Usually it follows it. Silent present moment awareness is what Ajahn Brahm's way of describing when you become peaceful and you have mindfulness in the present moment. And that mindfulness is then the preliminary step, which then later on gives rise to the bliss and all the... And then comes the bliss, and then after the bliss, that's when the actual nimitta appears. So... okay, so I hope if there's any other information you require, then the video will be available. Is it going to be an audio as well, Bhante, or just...
Yeah.
Yeah, audio, okay, yeah. Very good. Okay, so... Okay, this is one that was put outside my door, a note. So, dear Bhante, in this morning's discourse on volition, it emphasizes that no volition need be exerted. You also mentioned that volition gets in the way on the path. However, in the Chula and Mahasaropama Sutta, this is Majjhima 39 and 40, I think, it mentions that if his intention is short of the heartwood, it will be, if his intention is short of heartwood, it will become fulfilled, and he grows negligent and he lives in suffering. Presumably, intention and volition are different translations of Chaitanya. Well, there is a fair bit of difference between these suttas. And in the Saropama Sutta, the word actually, I looked it up this afternoon, is actually Paripunna Sankapa. Paripunna Sankapa means his intention, quite literally, is fulfilled. And there's a big difference there, because in the Saropama Suttas, it is general intention with a holy life that is fulfilled, right? He's satisfied, he's got some virtue or whatever, and he's satisfied with that, and he doesn't really want to progress any further. So that is the Saropama Sutta, whereas in the Chaitanya Sutta, you still have an intention to move further. It's just that when you sit in meditation, that is the time to let go of the will, right? So this is a meditation thing. That's when you reduce the will down. And it's even more narrow than that. It's specific for Samatha meditation. If you want to do pure Samatha meditation, that is the time to let go of all will. However, if you want to do, you want to contemplate something, or you want to do that sort of thing, and of course, a little bit of Chaitanya is actually required in that sort of situation. So this is very specific for that type of meditation, and it can really only start once mindfulness is properly established. Whereas in the Saropama Sutta, he gives up all desire to go any further on the path because he's happy with what has happened. There's quite different context for the two. Okay, and then you have another question on the Chula Saropama Sutta, where the order of the gradual training is Labha Sakara Siloka, then Sila Samadhi Nanadasana, and then the Buddha goes on to say about the four jhanas being higher than the previously mentioned Samadhi and Nanadasana. And you say here this seems a bit odd. And yes, I agree, it seems a bit odd, because usually Samadhi would include the four jhanas. And I had a quick look at Analeo's comparative study, which you also suggested in here. And there isn't, there is, the parallel in the Chinese doesn't have that. And Venerable Nalio suggests that, the jhana thing might actually, and then the immaterial attainment might actually be a later addition to that sutta. Okay, so very good. I hope that you're satisfied with that. Otherwise, you're welcome to come back and tell me off, whatever. Okay, dear Ajahn, in the suttas mentioning about the Noble Eightfold Path, I shall try to speak slowly so you can understand me. Sometimes I get a bit carried away, so please slow me down if it goes too fast. Explains the path developing in terms of Viveka Nisitang, Viraga Nisitang, Nirvana Nisitang, Vasanga Parinaming. Can you explain about this? I was actually going to explain that, but I sort of ran out of time. It was also a little bit on the side of the topic I was going to talk about. But the point of that seems to be, and this particular formula is more often found with the Bhujangas, with the awakening factors. It's found almost always together with the Bhujangas. And the point is that the higher aspects of the path, and the Bhujangas are very high aspects of the path, they have to be developed in conjunction with, because this is about deep samadhi, right, usually, and then deep insight following that. So it's always dependent on viveka nisitang, on seclusion. Viveka meaning, first of all, the kaya viveka, the seclusion of the body in a secluded place, acutely somewhere. And then the chitta viveka, these are the two commentarial terms. Chitta viveka meaning the seclusion of the mind in meditation. So this is supported by these things. Seclusion is important for the higher aspects of the path. Viraga nisitang, it is dependent on things fading away, right? Deep samadhi is dependent on the fading away of the body, of the senses that we talked about today, the fading away of the defilements, the fading away after a while of piti. All these things have to fade away, and then the samadhi arises as a consequence of that. So it is dependent on many things of the world disappearing, basically. Nirodha nisitang, the same thing, things have to disappear. That's what it depends on. And vasagga, parinaming, vasagga is like relinquishment again, right? Parinaming means to ripen. So it ripens in relinquishment, ripens in letting go, in the ending of craving. That's why it stops. So that is basically the meaning of those, roughly. That's how I understand them anyway. And, okay, number two. In the usual stock phrases in the suttas about the six senses, it goes, Tinnang Sangati Passo. Can you explain how this contact arising by getting together of those three? Okay, so yes, contact is, if you know dependent origination, in dependent origination you have the consciousness and you have the sense bases there, and once you have the sense bases, contact arises. Contact is a technical term which means that there arises something at the sense door. You feel something, you experience something. It's contact when something happens. You know, you might be hearing something and suddenly you see something. Contact arises at the eye faculty here. Or you may be seeing and then you feel something in the body. Contact arises in the body faculty. It's a term which means that you are experiencing something with one of the faculties. That really all it means. And that can only happen when three things come together. And the three things are the faculty itself, the eye, the object, and the consciousness. When those three come together, that's when you have contact. That's when you experience something. If consciousness is missing, you can't experience anything. If the object isn't there, you can't experience anything. If the eye is missing, you can't experience. Only with the three together does it arise. And that is called contact. And sometimes it can seem as if... So that basically is what all contact is. It is the very fact of three things coming together. It is strange that in the Abhidhamma, contact is explained as a separate mental quality, as if it is something apart from these three things coming together. I hope I'm not misinterpreting the Abhidhamma. Now, that's how I understand it. If you look at the various cetasikas, the mental qualities listed in the Abhidhamma, contact is one of them. But it looks like from the suttas that contact is just the fact of three things coming together, and it isn't really anything in its own right apart from that. Yes, sir.
Also, contact is mentioned in Passa, Nama Rupa.
It is. Passa is there, yeah. In Namakaya, in the Mahanidana Sutta, Passa is mentioned there. But there it could simply mean, I suppose, that maybe the coming together of the three. It's not clear then exactly what it means in that context. But it is mentioned there, that's true. Yeah. So, anyway, to me, it sounds like the phrase is Tinnang Sangati Passo, which seems to me that Passa actually is the coming together of the three. I mean, that's what the sentence actually means as it stands. Okay, so I don't think... okay. Was that your question? Yeah.
No,
it was not your question. Okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. Venerable Bhante, in the suttas it says, when you have a restless mind, then practice Prasadi, Samadhi, Upeka, enlightenment factors. If the mind is drowsy, lazy, then practice Dhammavicaya, Virya, Piti. Can you explain how it should be done in a practical sense? Okay, so what this means is that when you are restless, you have to find an object that calms you down, right? An object that gives rise to Prasadi and Samadhi. So that would be like the breath, right? The breath calms you down, it makes you peaceful. So anything which calms you down, or if you do walking meditation, you watch the feet, the touching of the feet on the ground, because it calms you down. So anything which calms you down. If you have the opposite, if you feel drowsy and lazy, you need inspiration, you need to be inspired. And that's when you do the Buddha Nusati, the Chaga Nusati, the Sila Nusati, to inspire you. So use a bit of reflection, use a bit of movement of the mind to remind yourself of these beautiful qualities. And then inspiration comes, the piti comes, and you can abandon the drowsiness. That's the theory anyway, that's how ideally it should be done. How easy that actually is a different matter. But that is kind of the idea behind that. So sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you're too restless. You try to watch the breath. It's difficult to watch the breath. It's painful. It doesn't feel right. So sometimes you have to just go and do something else completely, right? So you just have to, basically you have to gradually learn how your own mind works and then do the appropriate action which is required to take it towards peace and clarity and joy. Can you explain how Dutanga practices will help to the gradual training? Okay, so Dutanga practices are these kind of austere practices that you can add to your practice, basically. This is for monastics. And they include things like just having three robes, which isn't that much of that difficult. It's quite a fairly straightforward Dutanga practice. It includes just eating alms food, for example. But it also includes quite severe things like, the sitter's practice, the Nisajjika practice, which just means that you're sitting all the time, you never lie down. And that is only mentioned once or twice in the suttas. So because it's only mentioned once or twice in the suttas, it is not important, basically. Nisajjika is very kind of on the fringe of the suttas. It is not clear to me whether the Buddha really ever spoke about that sort of practice. You have to be very careful with that sort of practice because Nisajjika is a very kind of extreme thing. And I have heard of people who are kind of ruined the meditation for a long time by prematurely doing that sort of practice. There was one monk who was famous. He did Nisajjika. He made a determination. He was going to do Nisajjika until Ajahn Chah passed away. Unfortunately, Ajahn Chah lived on for another 8 years or something. He had this stroke, right? And everybody thought he was going to pass away at any time. But then he lived on for 8 years. So he did Nisajjika for 6 years or something. And after that, his meditation was basically shot. He was always falling asleep, always kind of drowsy. So you have to be very careful with these Dutanga practices. If you want to do it, make sure you're ready for it. Usually the mind should already be quite developed. You should have a sense of mindfulness, strong mindfulness at least. Your samadhi should ideally be going well. And then maybe you can consider these austere practices. But remember, it's a middle path, right? It's about being comfortable. So whatever makes you comfortable, if you're comfortable with the tanghas, it's fine. But if it makes you uptight, ill at ease, sick perhaps, and all these kind of things, please don't do the Dutanga practices. Certainly, my teacher Ajahn Brahm, he does not really recommend Dutanga practices because they tend to veer into an extreme and not be the middle way anymore. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you please let us know how, why you became a Buddhist and monastic life? Okay. I answered that question already to somebody else today, but basically, how it happened is that when I was at university in Norway, we had this kind of exchange programs, and I was able to go to Japan on this exchange program. I don't know why I wanted to go to Japan, but there was something about Asia that was very interesting. When you live in Europe, you want to go to Asia. When you live in Asia, you want to go to Europe, right? It's always like that. Something is different. You want to do something else. That's just life. So I went to Asia, and it was very exciting, you know, it was very interesting. And I read my first book on Buddhism, I saw all these enormous Buddha statues, I went to the Zen monasteries and all these things. And there was something about that which was very, I wouldn't say very powerful, but there was a sense of recognition there. And also my reading, I was very interested in reading about Buddhism for some reason. I don't know why. This is one of the fascinating things. Why is it that you want to go to Asia? Why is it that you want to read about Buddhism? Why are you interested in Buddhist monasteries? It's very weird, but that was actually the case. And the only explanation I have, I didn't have any friends that were Buddhist. I didn't know any Asian person whatsoever. I didn't had no idea about Buddhism before I went there. And yet there was this drawing towards these things, right? And the only explanation I have, it must come from somewhere in the past life. It's the sort of thing that makes me, you know, think that these kind of impulses in the mind, they must come from somewhere. And to me, it's very likely that comes from a past life. That's what I think. But then, when I got back to Norway after this trip, one of my friends, he had a book on meditation practice, and I started to meditate, and I had some nice experience in meditation. And this is really the most important thing. When you feel that, you know, you have some real experiences, and that really drew me towards this sort of path. And later on, while I was studying some more, I was studying too much probably, but I was studying some more, and then I realized that I'm not really interested in this. I don't want to live a life of where I have to work with finance and trade and these sort of things. I looked at the people around me. Did they look happy? Not really. Do I want to be like them? No. So I decided I wanted to try out the monastery. So I went to Chithurst Monastery in the UK. And that's where I started my monastic life in 1993. So that's 20 years ago now. Basically, that was it. I never sort of left that monastery afterwards. Okay, Venerable Sir, with reference to your preferred interpretation of contemplation of body in the body, how would you explain the next steps of feeling, mind, etc., as the word body, kaya, is not repeated? Okay, so in all of these ones, you have kaya, kaya nupassi, vedanesu, vedana nupassi, chitte, I think, chitta nupassi, dhammesu, dhamma nupassi. So the structure is all the same, all the way down. And sometimes that kind of structure, where the word is repeated in Pali, just means the word itself. It doesn't actually mean that you repeat the word on translation. That's why I said the simplest interpretation is simply that it means contemplate the body, contemplate feeling, contemplate mind, contemplate conditionality perhaps. So that is the simplest interpretation. But all the way down, the structure is the same. So if you interpret it the other way that I like to look at it, then it's contemplating a body in the body, contemplating a feeling among feelings, contemplating a state of mind in the mind, contemplating a type of conditionality among types of conditionality here. So it is the same principle all the way down. And if you look at the, for example, the feelings, this whole list of feelings listed, and you should contemplate each one, right? So you take one feeling among feelings. I hope that makes sense. Venerable Bhante, in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book, Ajahn Brahm explains the last four steps of Anapanasati as after emerging from jhana, contemplate anicca. If it fails to give understanding, then viraga. If it fails to give that, then nirodha. If it fails, and then patinissagaha. Isn't that you contemplate anicca that will lead to viraga, that will lead to nirodha, and so on? Is that what it says? I can't remember what it says. I haven't read that book for so long, but perhaps you're right. I would tend to agree with you that you, anicca is the most more preliminary type of contemplation, and you do that, and that then leads on to viraga, leads on to nirodha, etc. So I would tend to agree with that, but depending on the depth of your meditation, maybe you can go straight to contemplating nirodha and viraga. So I guess there isn't anything quite set about that. But generally, I would agree with you that usually is a sequence, and that is the way the Dhamma works. It is sequential, and the previous one or the subsequent one usually builds on the previous one. So they build on each other and then build each other up and become very powerful in that sense. So yes, I'm not sure exactly what Ajahn Brahm has in mind, or I would have to read the passage myself as well to make sure I know exactly what he's talking about. Okay, one, how to overcome experiencing of weird thoughts, okay, that can lead to one's own affliction during meditation, may generate into bad karma in dangerous situations. I mean, weird thoughts on an individual, monk, noble person, to whom you don't have any anger, ill will, cruelty, but these harmful thoughts arising, affecting mind and meditation, may happen into an unwholesome action. So they may lead into an unwholesome action, I suppose, is the idea. So how to stop these weird thoughts? I guess you're talking about a kind of delusion here, presumably. If it isn't a cruelty or harm, it's probably some kind of delusion of the mind. So how to stop that? I would say just let them be. If you try to stop, usually whatever you try to stop usually becomes worse. Because the mind wants to rebel, right? This is the problem with willpower. You hold it down, you try to control it, and then the mind rebels and it becomes worse. So usually the best thing is just to sit back and watch. And then the mind won't rebel because it's allowed to do whatever it wants. So you are just building up mindfulness instead and allowing things to be. So allow those weird minds. Don't be too afraid of them. One of the problems is that we are afraid of, you know, sometimes of our own mind, the power of the mind to overcome us. So one of the things we have to do is to accept ourselves. Accept, this is my mind. These are my thoughts. This is the way I am. It's okay here. You know, I'm not all bad. There's many good things in me. I wouldn't be here if there weren't many good things in me. So I can accept the negative as well. So just watch the negative, allow it to be here. And then when you watch it and you allow it to be, it doesn't have any power over you anymore. It's only when you go into the thoughts and you become the thoughts that they become powerful. But if you are able to stand back and watch, the power of those thoughts disappear. And then you can allow them to die down. And by watching, you can also start to understand how they are caused, right? What is bringing up these weird states of mind? You know that with anger, it's very simple to know the causality. With anger, it's always patiga, the sense of aversion or negativity towards something. You see the bad in something, you get anger. That causality is quite simple, and you can see that happening inside of yourself all the time. So you have to learn to see the positive side in something instead. Or sensual desire, it means you see the beauty in something. So you have to learn to see the repulsive side in that thing. And then you no longer have sensual desire for that thing. And in exactly the same way, the weird thoughts too will have a cause. So look for the cause. What is causing them? And once you see the cause, just by standing back and watching, then you can have an antidote, whatever that may be. To look at the thing in a different way. How can you look at the thing in such a way that the weird thought doesn't arise? So this is a better way than, this is at least one way of overcoming those thoughts, but don't use willpower. Does it happen as a phenomenon in the path of mindfulness and samadhi, stages of experience resulting from acts of mara and defilements? Yes, it is definitely defilement. It's just delusion, basically. And I guess we all have deluded thoughts every now and again. You know, sometimes you feel a bit confused, or you feel a bit, you know, strange, or whatever it is. This is all part of delusion, right? Of course, delusion goes much deeper than that, but it's part of that. But don't worry too much about where it comes from. It doesn't matter where these things come from. Sometimes people ask, oh, is this karma that I have to go through this? Who knows what it is? It doesn't matter if it's karma. This is the situation. Let's deal with it as it is. Let's not worry about where it comes from. That's my approach. Tends to be my approach anyway. Okay. Next one. Jhanas are said to be without thought, sensation, or perception. Not quite so, but I'll explain that in a second. Consciousness itself is tied to the sense bases, one of which is mind. With mind and mind object arises mind consciousness. Yeah? What is it then that experiences the jhana state? Is it the same faculty, i.e. power, or whatever, that we call upon to be passive observers? What is the Pali term, and in what suttas is this explained? Thank you. Okay, so it is not quite right to say that in jhana there is no sensation and perception. There is sensation, right? Remember, a jhana experience is one where you have pitisukha. Pitisukha is a sensation, it's a feeling. So you always have feeling in the jhanas. In fact, any state of consciousness whatsoever, there's going to be some sort of feeling associated with that. And the same is true with perception. There always must be a perception associated with consciousness. And this is from the suttas. It's in the, I think, the Chula Vedala Sutta, where it says that consciousness, feeling, vedana, and perception are always conjoined, and it is impossible to separate it from each other. So that is always there. So what is it that experiences the jhana state? It is that consciousness. It is mind consciousness. It is a consciousness, as you say here, with mind and mind object arises mind consciousness. So mind and mind object, the mind object is the some of the aspects of the jhana, and the mind and the mind consciousness. This is all explained in detail in the Abhidhamma, exactly how this works. I'm not sure now how this actually works, what the difference is between these things. But basically, they're all there. The mind consciousness is there, the mind is there, and the mind object are there. So all of that is present in the jhana state. I don't know. I mean, the Anupada Sudabhante is basically about all the different types of factors that occur within the jhanas, right? The type of factors that are there. So that's what that is about. I don't think this really asks about the factors so much. But maybe I misunderstood the question. Please ask again with a new question if I haven't answered it properly. Because sometimes there may be a communication problem. You never know. So please ask again. Okay, there are two ways for the body to disappear. One is when we do meditation gradually, and the body disappears gradually. And the other ways is when suddenly the body will become small like a pepper. Okay, like a peppercorn or something. Then bright like the midday sun, and then disappear. Then the meditator will feel that all the world is destroyed. Then the meditator automatically feel compassion for all human beings. So when Adam says the body disappears, which one is it? And what is the difference between the two? Okay, well, that is very interesting. I've never heard this before, so you must have some experience which sounds very exciting and interesting. The one I'm talking about is the gradual disappearance in meditation practice while you're watching the breath. The other disappearance, I don't think is mentioned in the suttas, but that doesn't necessarily mean it cannot happen. I'm not sure exactly what to comment on that one. Sounds quite exciting though, very interesting. So if it gives rise to wholesome states, it's usually good. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can someone with their eyes open see other peoples as skeletons? I would say the answer actually is yes, because it's amazing. The power of the mind is so strong that if you develop the mind strongly, you can almost see anything you like, pretty much. So if you bring up the perception of a skeleton and you kind of superimpose it on that person would look like a skeleton, right? It doesn't mean that you are actually seeing the skeleton in that person. It just means that you are bringing up the perception and you are seeing a skeleton that you have made in your own mind. It's your own creation. But because the mind is so powerful, you can see these things. That's what they say anyway. That's what I understand can be done. Bhante, yes?
That's in Visuddhi Magga, it mentioned that one mind passes and
one. Oh, that's right, yes, yeah, right, exactly, yeah, yeah. I remember that one, yeah.
Atikasanya.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I mean, the best skeleton to focus on is your own skeleton, right? Because we all have our own skeleton. It's funny because we are afraid of skeletons. Skeletons sort of remind us of death or something. But actually we all carry around a skeleton right inside of us. So it's right here. So it can't be that frightening. Okay. Venerable Ajahn, except 40 samatha objects mentioned in Visuddhi Magga, are there any other samatha objects mentioned in the suttas? If there are, please talk about some of those samatha objects. Okay, so the...
I think it's 39 in the suttas and 40 in Visuddhi Magga.
The last one is the object. I think it's the Upasama, something like that, a piece. But I think that's not really mentioned in the sutta. So. Yeah, okay. So basically what Bhante Metavihari is saying is that the list of 40 that are mentioned in the Visuddhi Magga are basically an extraction from the suttas. They are taken from the suttas, and there's one added to that which might be the Upasama, the peace contemplation or peace object. So basically the suttas and the Visuddhi Magga are the same. Is there anything more? I haven't really counted them like that and looked to see precisely if there's anything else. Maybe there is, yes, I think you're going beyond my my detailed knowledge now of the suttas. Does anybody else have any comment on that? Any samatha objects which is not mentioned in the Visuddhi Magga, which is in the suttas? I think 40 is enough, isn't it? Do we need more than that? They're not really samatha objects as such. They are more like contemplation objects, you know. So I wouldn't say they're samatha objects. The consciousness kasina, that's right, yeah. It would be, definitely. Definitely would be. But that is not in the Visuddhi Magga. Not sure. I think it probably is in the Visuddhi Magga. I think they're all there. So the Visuddhi Magga is pretty comprehensive. That's why it's so thick. Yeah. So okay. Okay. Let's move on to the next one. Dear teacher, about the Nilakasina. Okay. Now we're getting serious here. Okay. So, Nilakasina, what is the exact color, is it? Is it blue or green? Someone said it is blue, someone said it is green. Okay, well, this is one of those interesting problems. This has to do with the difference of, you know, how we look at the world and how they looked at the world at the time in India. At the time in India, they didn't seem to have any clear differentiation between blue and green. And this apparently is quite common in many societies that are pre the modern era. Actually, there wasn't often a distinction between blue and green, and they had just one name, and it was called Nila. So presumably what that means, that any color within that specter is acceptable for the Nila Kasina. So if you want to contemplate the Nila Kasina, then it seems any color which is blue or green spectrum would be acceptable for that. Okay. Can someone use other color, for example, pink color or orange color, to practice color kasina, to reach jhana? Someone said, can't reach jhana. Is it true or not? Okay, well, this, to be honest with you, this is a little bit outside my field of knowledge, to be quite frank. Now, we are certainly here moving outside of the kasina as mentioned by the Buddha in the suttas. I don't really know why he mentioned certain colors and he didn't mention others. I would guess that maybe it had to do with certain colors being available, so you could easily make like a disc or something and you can use that to focus your meditation on. That could be the reason, whereas other colors may not have existed at that time, or they were rare or difficult to produce or whatever. It could be something like that. But it seems to me that any color will do. It's basically just a method of focusing your attention, right? So any color, anything which helps you focus, anything you can attain samadhi on, that will be good enough. So if you want to use pink, if you like pink color, try pink. I'm sure that's okay. Or orange color would probably be fine as well. Anything, if you find it nice and you want to use that, give it a try and see what happens. But generally speaking, keep also in mind that the kasinas are not very taught very much in the suttas. It's really only when you come to the Visuddhimagga that the kasina kind of takes center stage. In the suttas, the Visuddhimagga are very peripheral, they're very on the side, not really part of the main meditation. Usually there's just a list says there are these 10 kasinas, and that's really all it says, right? And then the commentaries expand all these kind of things. And usually, the way I like to practice is I tend to leave the peripheral things to one side because they aren't explained that well. And because obviously, if the Buddha meant they were important, he would have talked more about them. So the very fact that they aren't talked much about, I think, is good enough reason to not spend too much time, perhaps, on the kasinas. Unless there is a very good reason why you want to use it. For example, you find that your meditation works very well using kasinas, for example. Now, if that is the case, and it doesn't work with other objects, then perhaps it can be used after all. So it's all about, you know, finding the what works for you. Okay, dear Ajahn, question one. It is said that to do metta meditation, if the meditator directs metta to himself, then he cannot reach jhana. Is it true or not, and why? Well, the metta meditation, as it described in the suttas, is very simple. In the suttas, it just says that you direct metta to the various quarters, the various directions, and you direct it to all as to oneself. In other words, there is no differentiation. All beings are included in the metta, right? But sometimes people like to use the method described in the Visuddhimagga, because sometimes directing it to all directions may not work, it may be too lofty or too difficult. So to give rise to the sense of metta, they like to use the method in the Visuddhimagga. And that starts off with metta towards oneself. But that's only the beginning, right? It's only to get started. So if you just start with yourself, that in itself is not a problem. It's just to get the feeling going. And then when the feeling gets going, then you can spread it out to other people. You can like expand the circle that you include in your metta meditation. Expand and expand until everyone is included. So these are the skillful means. But in the end, the metta should certainly be directed to all beings. And all beings includes yourself. Don't leave yourself out. Bring in yourself as well. We all need metta. And we certainly ourselves as well. Okay, question number two. It is said to do metta meditation if you focus on one who is dead, then it cannot reach jhana, even if someone don't know that the person had died? I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not sure why these things are said. These are commentarial things, not found in the suttas. What is important is to give rise to the feeling, right? If you can give rise to the feeling of metta towards somebody who is dead, wonderful. Use that dead person and then expand it from that. It's not, you know, we're not just using one object and staying with that. We're using objects to give rise to feelings and then expanding it afterwards. And that is the whole point here. So sometimes I find it a little bit strange because it's not as if you stay with one object all the time. So if it works for you, if you have somebody you love dearly, who you thought was a wonderful person, and they have passed away, and you find it easy to have metta for that person, use that object and then go further. Okay. Next one. Dear Bhante. Oops, one question has been erased, so we go to the second one. Okay. As per Anguttara 6.10 Mahanama Sutta, does not recollection of one's own good strengthen the ego? Okay, it can strengthen the ego if you use it wrongly. If you sort of, you know, feel proud of your goodness, or you feel kind of, I am great, I'm better than them, and this sort of thing. If you use it in that way, then it's no good. But it's not really like that. You know, when you become peaceful, and if you think about your own goodness, there's a natural joy that comes from goodness. And that joy is a very, you know, it's a pure kind of joy that comes from these things. And it's not the ego joy. You will know the difference. You just need to think about it, and you will feel the difference inside of you between the boosting of the ego and the joy that comes from purity. They're very different feelings. So, you know, and as long as you can differentiate, then you can guide yourself in the right direction. But obviously, because the Buddha taught this kind of thing, it is obviously not something you need to be too afraid of. It is said, only one who sees the Rupa Kalapa and separate into the four elements, then can say one see Rupa as real Rupa. Is it necessary to do this or not? Okay, this Rupa Kalapa, again, this is Abhidhamma terminology. A Kalapa is like the, according to the Abhidhamma, the smallest possible aspect of form. And it's not mentioned in the suttas. Because it isn't mentioned in the suttas, I really don't think it is necessary to see these things. Otherwise, if it was necessary, it would have been in the suttas, right? This is one of the things, when I see that the commentaries, the Visuddhimagga and the Abhidhamma expand on the suttas, they give great detail where the suttas don't, then maybe it's right, but is it necessary here? Why, if it was necessary, surely the Buddha would have talked about these things. So I always like to come back to the Buddha's teachings. At the time of the Buddha, people were able to practice the way the Buddha taught. There were lots of arahants, lots of people successful in meditation. If we look at history, I think it is usually it is reasonable to assume that there were more arahants at the time of the Buddha than any other time in history. And that is when they had the simple teachings in the suttas. So I think those are the most effective teachings. So I say, it's just my opinion, let's stick with those. Let's not kind of expand out to all these other kind of teachings. That's my feeling here. So I don't think it's necessary here. I think all you have to do is to purify yourself, attain samadhi, and then remember the impermanence of those states that you have just been through. And that is enough to cause enlightenment. This is what it says in the suttas again and again. It doesn't need all these complicated and vipassana techniques, which I explained in particular in the Visuddhimagga, for example. It's just my personal opinion, and feel free to disagree. Okay, Venerable Ajahn, if we focus on pain, is it right concentration or wrong concentration? It is neither right nor wrong. You can focus on pain if you like, but in my experience, it is not all that useful. You focus on pain, doesn't get you very far. I would think, and all the other, for one thing, it isn't all that useful. Secondly, it's painful, right? Focusing on pain is painful. It goes without saying. So because it is painful, and because I quite like, you know, the happy path, the easy path, maybe, I don't know if that's a bad habit or what, but I like the easy way, and most people like the easy way. Why make things difficult if it can be done the easy way? So let's try to reduce the pain rather than increase the pain. So I say, if you feel too much pain, usually it blocks samadhi from arising. Why? If you have pain in the body, usually the mind goes to the body and is concerned with the pain, right? Of course, you can do like vipassana, you can try to separate yourself and see it for what it actually is. But often that is quite difficult. And I'm not sure if the insight you gain is all that profound anyway, because you haven't had samadhi yet, right? So you may understand the pain a little bit, but how much insight does it actually give? I'm not sure if it gives that much insight. So I say, make the body feel at ease, make the body disappear, and then you can focus on the mind, and then you can have a good time, you can enjoy yourself, and then it's likely that you will last a long time as a meditator. I often hear that on certain vipassana retreats, 90% of the people who go there the first time never return, because it's just too painful, there's too many difficulties. And that is too many people leaving, right? 90% is too many. We want to encourage people to meditate. The potential of meditation, like we saw in that sutta yesterday, somebody who puts forth effort, the one who is lazy, he is forsaking a great good in the world. Meditation is a potential great good. We want to encourage people. So we have to give them a type of meditation which actually works, which is enjoyable, not one which is just painful. That is how I see it. A lot of these things are just my personal opinions, but I feel it is also based on the suttas to a large extent. So, anyway, if someone wants to follow Ajahn Chah's teaching, will you suggest he go to Thailand or Australia, Ajahn Brahm's monastery? What is the difference? Okay. I would not tell you to follow Ajahn Chah's teaching. I don't think that is the right thing to do. I would say follow the Buddha's teaching. Be a disciple of the Buddha. Ajahn Chah might be a great teacher. Some of the things he said might be wonderful. But in the end, it's the Buddha who is the most inspiring person and who has the most profound teachings. If somebody asks me, should I be a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, I would say, be a disciple of the Buddha. Don't be a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. I'm not saying Ajahn Brahm's teachings are wrong, but the Buddha, it should be the primary concern and the primary teacher. So don't, I would never suggest to follow Ajahn Chah's teachings. And anyway, Ajahn Chah's teachings are very hard to access sometimes. Remember that all we have now of Ajahn Chah's are a few recordings, a few books that have been put together by certain people. We don't even know anymore really what Ajahn Chah taught. If you ask one monk, he will say one thing. Ask another monk, he will say something else. And Ajahn Chah is not there to defend himself, so he can't tell you what he actually taught. So because of all those complications, go to the suttas. That is the purest, the most easily accessible teachings. The ones that have been specifically made to be handed down for hundreds and thousands of years. And that those we still have. That should be the main thing. And then you can use other teachers to top that up. If you find Ajahn Chah inspiring, then read some of his books and get inspired by that. Great. If you find Ajahn Brahm's teaching inspiring, read some of that and listen to his talks and get inspired. That's all very wonderful. That's what I would recommend. But generally speaking, if you want to sort of follow in the Thai forest tradition, should you go to Australia or should you go to Thailand? It's very hard to say. It depends on you know, where you feel inspired. It depends on where you feel at ease, where it feels natural for you, what feels good. There isn't any kind of, you know, you can't really say what is the right place to go. But you are not going to find Ajahn Chah's teaching anywhere, basically. That's the reality of it. If you go to a monastery in Thailand, you will find the teachings of whoever is the senior monk in that monastery. Okay. Dear Venerable, what is sunyata sanya? State of meditation, if so, is it useful? Okay, sunyata samadhi. There is something called sunyata samadhi, and it is described in the suttas. The sunyata samadhi is when you think, you reflect, everything is empty of a self. I think everything, something like that. Or you think everything is empty of a self, and everything is empty of what belongs to a self. Something like that. That's how you reflect. And when you reflect like that, if the reflection works, you enter sunyata samadhi. And that is where there is no, the sense of self is gone, right? That's basically what it is. So everything is empty of a self, and everything is empty of what belongs to a self. Is it useful? Probably quite useful. It's probably a good thing to do. I don't know. There is very little information about it in the suttas. It's very hard probably to get good instruction on how to practice this type of meditation, because I'm not sure if many people do it. I heard Ajahn Brahm told me once that he tried this meditation, so maybe you can go to Ajahn Brahm and ask for some instructions. But it's not so clear how to do it. And usually you probably need quite good samadhi already to be able to do this kind of thing here. So it's quite an advanced type of meditation, right? It's not easy to do here. But,
I think there's
Appanahita. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Animitta, Sunyata, and Appanahita Samadhi. Those are the three ways. So one is like objectless, one is the emptiness meditation, and one is the directionless meditation. And none of them are explained in much detail. So because of that, again, because they aren't explained in much detail, I tend to focus on those things in the suttas that are very clear and very obvious. That's usually my approach. Okay. So, dear Adam, what exactly is Yoniso Manasikara? How is it more than wise thinking? Why is it so important? Okay? Yoniso Manasikara is very important. It is said in the Anguttara ones that this is one of those foundational factors on the path that is required from the very beginning. And you have to take it with you all the way along the path, from the very beginning to the very end. That which gets you started to practice meditation, that which gets you started to listen to the Dhamma, to read the suttas, to do anything which is right, is Yoniso Manasikara. Literally, Yoniso, Yoni means womb, and womb is means like source, right? The womb is a source of something, so it means source. And Manasikara literally means work of the mind. Usually attention is how it's translated. So it's like attention that relates to the source, right? And the source of things, the source of things, usually you go back and understand how things originate. So it basically means something like wise attention. That's the basic meaning of that. And if you don't attend wisely, of course, you don't get anywhere, right? Everything we do, just thinking that you want to be a kind person, that's wise thinking. That's Yoniso Manasikara. I want to do something good. I want to be generous. That's Yoniso Manasikara. I want to meditate. I want to learn how not to be angry. That's Yoniso Manasikara. All of these things are Yoniso Manasikara. So, is it more than wise thinking? It's anything which is wise, right? It can be wise thinking, it can be a wise perception. It can be any time you direct your mind in a wise way, it is Yoniso Manasikara. A jhana state is definitely Yoniso Manasikara, but there's no thinking there, right? So it doesn't have to involve thinking. Why is it so important? Because it carries you along all the way from the beginning to the end. Without Yoniso Manasikara, there is nothing whatsoever. You've had it. You're doomed to suffering. So, sorry about that. Okay. Okay. Venerable Ajahn, you are so compassionate towards us. Okay, that's very kind of you to say that. Take much generosity to teach. Okay, to teach us tirelessly. Please rejoice in your goodness. Oh, okay, that's a very kind little note. No question. saves me the effort and just kindness back. That's very, very good. Okay. Okay, blank one, sir. Okay, so here is a long one. Venerable sir, some teachers say that the ascetic Gautama learned the methods of jhana under the teachers Alara Kalama Uddagranpa. I know what's coming now. And mastered the jhanas in no time, and that the unique discovery of the Buddha was Vipassana. A respected teacher Ajahn Brahm, whom we follow, says Buddha practiced the way to enlightenment through jhana, which was his discovery. Can you please clarify? Okay. The suttas say that the Buddha awoke to jhana. It doesn't actually say discovered jhana as such, but a couple of suttas which says that he awoke to jhana. Buddhati is the Pali term. And exactly what that means is uncertain. It can mean many different things, but I would guess it just means that he understood the significance of jhana, the power it has on the path. It could also mean that he discovered it in the sense that he had it as a child, right? Because he had it as a child, he hadn't been taught by anybody. So it was, in that sense, it was his own discovery. He noticed jhana for himself, first of all. So either whether he understood the power of jhana to attain awakening, I don't know how well you know your suttas, but if you know Majjhima number 36, that is what the Buddha says. He reflected to himself, okay, I've tried the ascetic practices, I've tried the sensual pleasures in the household life, none of them work. Is there another way to awakening? And then he reflected back to his childhood experience. Yes, this must be the path to awakening, the jhanas. This is what he says in that sutta. It's very clear. So in that sense, he certainly understood the significance of jhana and the importance of it. And then the fact that he also discovered it as a child means that in one way he also discovered jhana as well. So both ways of looking at it are, I think, acceptable. And then it's true, he did meditate under the teachers Alara Kalama and Uddagramaputta, and it seems that they may have taught the immaterial attainments. So then he practiced there as well, possibly those attainments. Whether those teachers actually taught those attainments, I think an argument can be made that perhaps they didn't, and perhaps that it was some other kind of meditation that they practiced. But it's not an argument which is perhaps all that powerful. It's very hard to make out what actually may have been the case and may not have been the case. But there is some very substantial differences between the main sutta that talks about this is the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, Majjhima 26, which talks about the search of the Buddha, the noble search. And there is a lot of difference between that sutta and the Chinese version of that sutta. There's a lot more added in the Pali. The Pali is much longer. And the Chinese may be an earlier version of the same sutta. And because of those differences, it is hard to really... it may be that there are things there which aren't quite as they look, perhaps. Perhaps. These are just speculations, really. It doesn't matter. But either way, however that is, I think there are some grounds for saying that, in a way, the Buddha did discover jhana, for himself at least, and he also awoke to its significance. So those two things in particular.
And Kushodas
Rupa Jhana.
Uh-huh. That they had that pathway.
Right, okay, yeah.
Not really the jhana.
Not really the jhana, sir. Okay. Okay, thanks, Bhante. Yeah, so Bhante Metta Vihara is saying that there's a sutta in the Sanghita Nikaya where it says that people of other sects use the Brahma Viharas to enter the immaterial attainments. Okay, so the Buddha's discovery is quite broad. He discovered many things, right? And part of his discovery was certainly the power of jhana. Okay. So, okay, dear Ajahn, the Buddha was a great list maker. Great list maker, okay. Now I see what you mean now, okay. Whilst teaching, a majority of people remember below if there are diagrams and map making, etc. Can you please point to a good source of them? The majority of people remember because remember better if there are diagrams, mind maps, etc. Can you please point to a good source of them? Of course, the list making of the Buddha is because they lived in an oral culture, right? So it had to be delivered orally. And when you make a list, it's quite easy to remember. You say, there are these five things, and then you list five things, and then you say, these are the five things. That's how the suttas go again and again. That's how they work. And it's because it's an oral culture. That's how you do things in an oral culture. And it's also quite good for memory anyway, because you have a beginning, a body, and then an ending. Others like diagrams and mind maps. I think the mind map is really, if you have something like the gradual training we have been going through now, it's quite logical, right? The sequence is quite logical. You start with purifying your virtue, then comes purifying the mind, then comes the meditation practice, then come the jhanas. If you start to understand the structure, I think the structure is what is important here. Once you understand the structure of the Dhamma, you can see how it all fits together very nicely. That, I think, is the important thing here. So try to understand the structure. One of the ways to do that is to start with a fairly simple book. Don't sort of plunge into the Samyutta Nikaya. If you plunge into the Samyutta Nikaya and you open up a reading about the Salayatana Samyutta, it's likely that you will, particularly if you are a beginner, you're probably going to give up very fast, and it might seem very dry. But take a book like, if you prefer to read in English, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Buddha's Words, which is a very nice book. It's an anthology. The suttas are grouped together in nice sections, talking about ordinary life, talking about the problems in life, talking about the path of meditation, about wisdom, all these things. Grouped together very nicely in a nice system, so it leads from here, leads all the way to a full awakening. You see the whole process there. And then there's lots of notes that explain what's going on. There are nice introductions to explain. And Venerable Bodhi is, generally speaking, a very good and reliable translator. He is certainly my preferred translator if I have a choice. So try that. I'm not aware that there are any diagrams or mind maps beyond that, basically. It is a conceptual map. It's something you have to build up inside of you. And once the pieces fit together, actually, it isn't that difficult to see how it all fits together here. Okay, it's 5 minutes over time, but I will just, if it's okay with everybody, I'll just do two more questions. Any complaints? Everybody happy with that? Okay, so let's do the last two ones. Dear Bhante, could you please elaborate on the following terms below? Regarding the yogi's state of mind as they undertake the practice of purification of mind. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. Maybe you are familiar with the Pali used here. Okay, yeah, diligent I know certainly what is. Diligent is appamada. And appamada is a very, very important term in the suttas. It's one of those things that, again, have to go with you from the very beginning of the path to the very end. What it means is not to be negligent, right? To be heedful. I don't know if you're familiar with the word heedful. Heedful means like to be careful, to be circumspect, to think carefully, not to take hasty conclusions, to reconsider if necessary. Heedfulness has a very beautiful ring if you understand the meaning of that term. And that carefulness, that care on the path, is something that you have to take with you from the beginning to the end. Always reflect carefully. It's closely related to Yoni Somanasikara we talked about before. And diligent is not a very good translation. Heedful is much better, in my opinion. Diligent means somebody who's always working hard, right? It's not about working hard. It's about working carefully and wisely. Ardent, atapi. Atapi is a word which is derived from tapas. Tapas is this idea of asceticism in India, and atapi is actually derived from that. How much of that meaning is retained in the word is hard to say. Basically, it means like energy, right? You have energy. You are trying to overcome these things. That's essentially what it means. So you have energy. So you are heedful, you have energy, and resolute, I think, is pahitatta or something like that, which basically is just a synonym for effort, for applying yourself. So these things are using energy and effort in a careful and wise way. That's essentially what these things come out as. Okay, then you have another words here. Ardent, clearly aware and mindful. Yeah. Atapi sampajano satima. That's what we were talking about before today, right? Sampajano is a result of the practice of sampajanya, where you have clear comprehension, full awareness of things. And that sampajanya then bring with you into the satipatthana when you practice satipatthana. Mindful, again, is just the presence of the mind that you establish through all the preliminary practices. And atapi is again that energy. Yeah. Okay, last question for tonight. Venerable Ajahn, what are your comments in the Pali Canon? What are comments in the Pali Canon? What are comments in the Pali Canon? Commentary? Is that what it means? What are commentary in the Pali Canon? Maybe that's what you mean. Okay. Okay, I'm just going to guess that that's what you mean, because if that's wrong, please come back and write another note later on. So perhaps you mean the commentary on the Pali Canon. Commentary, so the Pali Canon is the word of the Buddha, right? Sometimes it's a bit more, but essentially it's the word of the Buddha. Then, after the Buddha's word will lay down, people will ask him themselves, what does it mean? I don't understand what it means. And the teacher will say, it means this. And that's how the commentary arose. Then you start to collect all these teachers saying various things about the meaning of the suttas. And that gradually built up into the commentary. And that was then collected by Venerable Buddhaghosa, the famous monk who lived at the Mahavihara in Anuradhapura in the 5th century, and he collected all these ancient commentaries and produced the authorized commentaries, if you like, and he translated them into Pali, so they are available to us today. So today we have these authorized commentaries, which are the authorized comments on the Pali Canon, and they give like the view of the Mahavihara community. Mahavihara is the great ancient monastery in Anuradhapura. They give their view of how the suttas should be read. And commentaries are usually very good. There's lots of useful information there, lots of good points being made. But we need to remember that the commentaries, we don't know basically who wrote them. We don't know who made these comments. It may have been people who were very wise, but sometimes some of those comments may not have come from people who were that wise. So it means that we are allowed to subject the commentaries to our own kind of judgment and criticism. Take them seriously, respect what they say, but there's no absolute requirement to take on board what they say. So if you feel the commentary might be a bit dodgy, that's allowable. You are allowed to do that. When it comes to the word of the Buddha, you should be much more careful with thinking it's dodgy. It's more likely your own thinking is dodgy than the sutta is dodgy. Right? But even there, even with a sutta, sometimes there are dodgy passages, things that have changed over time, things that aren't as original as it used to be. So even there, it's good to use judgment when you read them. So, I hope that answered your question. If I got it completely wrong, and you were meaning something completely else, different, then please come back on that one. Okay, so... that's enough for this evening, so we'll see you again tomorrow morning. So let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.